Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books and Gender Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Da-In Choi, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Min Jung Kim about her book, Elusive Belonging, Marriage, Immigrants, and Multiculturalism in Rural South Korea. Min Jung Kim is an associate professor and department chair of sociology at San Diego State University. Min Jung, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, thank you for coming. We're very excited. To begin, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I am from South Korea, and currently I'm teaching at San Diego State. My research areas, they are about gender and family in the context of international migration. And that's the topic we're going to focus on, I guess, with my book today. I also study gender and race in the media. I have smaller projects about that. Especially in the U.S. media.
Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah, media is especially like such a important topic right now, too. I'm really excited for you to explore that. My next question is, how did you come to write Elusive Belonging?
So when I was a PhD student, I was looking for an interesting, you know, what a topic for my dissertation. And then I watched this Korean documentary show, 그것이 알고 싶다, about marriage immigrants. And it was very fascinating because when I was in Korea and, you know, my previous knowledge was how Koreans are rather not so friendly to foreigners. And that particular documentary showed that these rural elderly Koreans were really kind of embracing Filipina marriage immigrants. And I got really curious and I wanted to find out. So I did my field work for my dissertation project. And then I published several articles and book chapters. And then I poured the other stories that I could not put in published articles and book chapters into this book. And it touches, and I was happy to write this book because I could kind of show this broader picture of the communities that I examined in this book.
Yeah, I was really impressed by your ethnography as well. And it is really in-depth. And I wanted to ask you, actually, because you were mentioning how your motivation was from this documentary. You do talk about in your introduction how Filipina marriage immigrants are seen as different from, for example, like Joseonjok marriage immigrants that used to be very prevalent, but then now not so much anymore because the trend is changing. So can you tell us more about the particularity of Filipina immigrants, marriage immigrants' experiences?
Sure. So in Korea, generally, international marriage was something that people really didn't embrace before, at least before the 21st century. But there were people who married internationally. We've seen a lot of cases of, you know, Japanese, Korean couples, and American and Korean couples. Mostly it was between Korean women and Japanese or American men. And we knew about pen pals between Korean women and European men, Korean women and European men, but not so much with Korean men and foreign women. And also, I'm sorry, Dain. What was the question?
Oh, yeah, no worries. Yeah, that happens actually all the time. Oh, yeah, my question was, maybe I didn't ask you clearly. Because in the introduction, you talk about how Joseonjok marriage immigrants, for example,
right.
Are...
Sorry. So there were international marriage. However, they were with people who had historical connections to Koreans. Japan is a neighboring country. So Korea and Japan has a long history. And the United States, their presence in the U.S., especially in Korea, especially after the Korean War, kind of opened opportunities for Koreans and Americans to me. But Filipinas were really new to Koreans. We did not necessarily have close relationship, well, any relationship with the Philippines. So seeing, I guess, except for Filipino migrant workers who started coming in the 90s. So it was really new to see Filipinas marrying Korean men. And they were different. They were different in the sense that their looks were different. Their cultures were different. Of course, Koreans and Chinese and Japanese, some people would say that they look different. Their cultures are different, but East Asians, sometimes they have a long history together. So Filipinas, they were kind of newcomers to Koreans. And that's what really intrigued my interest in this topic, because this really was a new era for Korea.
Interesting. Yeah. And, you know, talking about history and how people view these marriage immigrants, this actually reminds me of your discussion in chapter 6 about how race is defined in Korea. You also talk about this in your introduction too, and how various inclusion and exclusion strategies are used. So can you talk a little bit more about the definition of race in Korea? Because I think it's really intriguing because it is different from how we conceptualize it in America. As well as the multiculturalism projects and policies regarding this marriage immigrants by the Korean government.
So I did talk about race in my book because race was something that Koreans or the Korean government did not talk about, especially related to multicultural families. Of course, the term multicultural family that the Koreans used to describe the families with the marriage immigrants has been criticized and contested by many scholars and pundits. I argue in my book that the term multicultural family actually overlooks the issues related to race. In the United States, maybe Asians, regardless where they are from, they are kind of lumped into this one category of Asians or Asian Americans. However, there are a lot of diversity, not just in terms of language and cultures, but also appearances and looks. And unfortunately, in Asia, there is racism in some countries against other Asian countries, against other Asians. And in Korea, based on people's skin color, their Koreans have prejudice or biased opinions. And Filipinos or Filipinas whose skin color is considered darker, they are also a target of racist attitude and discrimination by Koreans. And I wanted to kind of highlight that. And I think it adds to existing racial discourses in Korea. So related to racism in Korea, I would like to recommend the book Imperial Citizens by Nadia Kim. And she really delves into this history of racial discourses in Korea and how it follows this, very simplified discourse that was introduced in the modern era, late 19th century and early 20th century. In Korea, prior to the 21st century, three races existed, white and black and yellow. And in a way, the introduction of Filipinos and other Asian migrants to the Korean society, we can really complicate and open up this discussion about race and racism. However, even though racial discrimination and racist attitudes exist in Korea, unfortunately, I don't think scholarly conversations about race has been galvanized.
Within the Korean scholarly communities,
right? I think there are some scholars who definitely focus on racial discussions or discussions on race and racism. And there are scholars who focus on African migrants' experiences in Korea. However, I don't think they have. There was a huge interest in discussing race and racism in a more nuanced, deep way.
I totally agree with that. And this is something that I felt too in my own research and also my personal experiences as well, because you do often see representation and people's interaction of South Asians and, you know, people call them like 저쪽 사람, which like other than, and because I think race has traditionally really focused on America. So how, you know, Asians, and then as you said, you know, really eloquently, like how America just lumped together Asians, even though there's huge like economic disparity, like educational disparity within this group, and also the treatment within Asia itself. I think that it just really flattens out the discourses that happens.
Problematic, especially with the Korea's multicultural family policy, is that from the beginning, they emphasize the cultural differences to explain the experiences of families or internationally married. And in a way, they kind of promoted this idea that marriage immigrants assimilate, or if they learn more about Korean culture and language, their troubles will go away or will be resolved in some way. There, the idea is that if we can minimize and alleviate differences, we can find some kind of clarity. I don't know. But the problem is that it is not just cultural differences. It is not something that we can learn to assimilate and kind of overcome. That approach actually ignores racial prejudice, which is based on skin color that cannot be changed. So in a way, their approach did not necessarily consider the divide that cannot be easily overcome. And that's why I felt it was important to point out racialization of marriage immigrants in Korea. although that was a kind of part of the chapter, but I felt strongly about including that.
Yeah, thank you for that insightful comment, because I think that cultural difference can sometimes, I mean, can very often actually be like a softer hegemony in a way. Mm-hmm. It seems not as disruptive as racial difference, but at the same time, a lot of, you know, horrible like assimilation policies happen under, you know, cultural differences. So I really appreciated that. And that actually brings me to your chapter 5, Making Multiculturalism, and your critic of makeshift multiculturalism, and how you point out that community volunteers and social workers, so-called multicultural agents, expect, you know, repayment in a way for this service that they are giving to marriage immigrants, that you call economy of gratitude. So I wonder whether, you know, you can tell us a little bit more about makeshift multiculturalism and economy of gratitude and how that plays a role in your book.
Right. Thank you so much for asking that question. I should first mention that makeshift multiculturalism was the term that was used by the late great Nancy Abelman, who passed away recently. And she, in her work about Korea's multiculturalism policies, she talked about how Korea's multiculturalism sense that the policies and also policy measures, they were created and practiced in a really hasty manner. And that's how a lot of, you know, Korean government officers work too. They have a goal, and a lot of people get together and they try to make it happen. And that kind of drive can really work well for certain things. However, we question, is it possible to do that with multicultural policies? So, for example, when I was in my field, I saw a lot, I mean, these multicultural agents who I call, they are social workers, government agents, and community members who take a lot of interest in the lives of marriage immigrants. And they come with a lot of goodwill. They really want to help marriage immigrants. However, even scholars, experts, do not necessarily think about what multiculturalism means and what a multicultural society looks like. And of course, over the years, people, scholars and activists criticized Korea's multicultural policies for being assimilationist because they began to learn, they began to realize that's not what we want to see. However, that is not necessarily the case for everyone. Government agents, they are oftentimes, they are assigned to their department to serve marriage immigrants. I mean, I cannot say for all of them. I hope and I assume that some of them come with some qualifications. But many of them, they are there without necessarily specialized knowledge in multiculturalism because it was new to the whole country. Korea always considered itself as homogeneous country, and Koreans always considered themselves as a homogeneous people. So when they came and they came with a goal to accomplish something in their quarter in a given time, it was really difficult to see meaningful conversations or some critical dialogues among themselves. So when I was in the field, I was there teaching Korean to marriage immigrants. We would often get a survey from a university professor in different units, and there's no introduction from the university professors. Just the surveys were given to the Catholic Church where we have these Korean classes, and they just, marriage immigrants would just fill out the form. So there were a lot of interest in them, but oftentimes Koreans were kind of rushed to do, conduct a survey, produce reports, and that's it. So, I mean, I do want to believe that some folks, they try to do their work for better future for marriage immigrants. And there were some very meaningful changes that were made over the years. However, when you think about the amount of work that was done and the amount of money that was invested in for this huge multicultural family policies since the mid-2000s, one has to wonder how much considering how much we spend, one could argue that we really didn't make that much progress.
Yeah, and tying it back to the previous comments that you make, having one ideal of multiculturalism in itself is such a political project, and this idea of cultural differences itself is very racialized. So thinking of all those nuances and some of the harmful aspects of cultural difference as a concept or an idea, yeah, I think I can definitely see how this project, you know, even if Asians have goodwill, can be co-opted in a way. Yeah. So I thought it was very insightful. Yeah.
Yeah. And also, I think to your earlier question about this multicultural economy of gratitude, which I kind of built on Ali Hochschild's concept of economic gratitude in her work, The Second Shift. And I apply that concept to this situation where Korean multicultural agents, community members and government agents, they, like I said, they want to really help marriage immigrants. And that's why they implemented multicultural family policy to help support marriage immigrants to make a better life in Korea. I should say that when they do that, they did so with gratitude. A lot of marriage immigrants came to marry, especially rural bachelors. And in Korea, since the 80s, we had this social issue of rural bachelors who could not find wives. And the Korean government really took interest in these men's well-being. They created actually a national committee to basically find wives for these men. And then marriage immigrants came and almost this problem looked like it was going away. So multicultural agents, they started their activities to help these women out of gratitude, solving this issue of rural bachelors. However, what is interesting is that while they express their gratitude, while they offer these services, public services for marriage immigrants, they realized that that gratitude scale was being tipped over. And in exchange, they wanted marriage immigrants to stay in marriage, no matter how difficult their married life is. And they also wanted them to assimilate. So I found that really fascinating. And it doesn't just happen here, everywhere. Immigrants, when they go to a new country, the host country oftentimes expect them to make contributions so that their presence in the host country can be deserving. We want them to be contributing members of the society. Then you can have a better relationship with the state, the government. But one has to wonder, what does that mean for refugees? What does that mean for people who just want to move to another country?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, that is such an important question. And I think especially now in this politically turbulent time where, because there has always been this rhetoric of deserving immigrants, that you deserve to be here, you're legal. But then under the Trump administration, obviously that's just getting like pushed, and, you know, any kind of racialized immigrants are now just seen as undeserving, and that just also has a whole baggage of a history of like exclusion and racialization. Actually, as an international student in the US right now, I am having a lot of trouble as well. Like, I used to be welcomed in this country, but now I'm no longer, and my status is in jeopardy because of the new administration. So I think this like question of deserving immigrants contributing back to the economy is really like relevant, even though I guess I'm in a different place from the marriage immigrants that you have interviewed and done the field work with. But yeah, that's a very insightful. Yeah, thank you for your insightful words.
I think application is important to think about. Even in the United States, immigrants were allowed when they have families already here, or you have to have money, or you have to have educational capacity. So we never accept anybody without condition. There is always a screening process for immigrants. And it is not conservatives' measure. Liberal and progressive politicians before, they created these measures and regulations, immigration policies. And that policy, when that, I think that policy also had this room for slippery slope, because in every, in different times, people will make a different assessment who are deserving immigrants. So before, people who pursue higher education, they were welcome. However, now some folks argue that that's not enough, because they are actually, they argue that we are opening up for opportunities to take more of our jobs, right? Students do not necessarily make contributions, is what they would say. In Korea, which is fairly recent destination country, we started receiving migrants and immigrants since 1990s. And of course, initially, they were migrant workers. And from the very beginning, even now, Koreans do not have the kind of policies that the U.S. has to allow them to stay after a certain period. All migrant workers are considered as temporary migrants. We do not necessarily have open door policy for migrants. However, married immigrants were welcomed. they were welcome because they could, like I said, solve the social issue that they had. And nowadays, if you look at actually immigration policy in Korea, they do talk about how they want to create more space for professional migrants, people who who are equipped with more educational background or professional background. So they are creating these measures that could be used against people who do not have what they are looking for. However, one has to wonder, what is the boundaries? What is the border? And why do we have these? Why do we have this kind of selective process for immigrants? If you're going to have immigrants, why can't you just, you know, accept all? Maybe that's kind of an idealist way of looking at it. But I think it is a good question to pursue.
Yeah, definitely. And it is definitely really sad that this neoliberal idea of autonomous, enterprising individuals who make monetary contribution is seen as the only ideal of immigrants or deserving citizens in a country, because it is definitely really internalized. And I think that's why for a lot of people, it seems that it's just a matter of course. I think disturbing part of it is that people don't even contest it. It's right, yeah, and I think that is when that is also what shows that neoliberalism is just so powerfully just ingrained in our society. And challenging that with the question that you asked, why can't we accept more people? Like, what is the meaning of border? I think that's definitely a starting point for us to contest that and talk about how valuation of human life should go beyond that and be more holistic. And I mean, yeah, for me as well, I think we should just value everyone. But then I think that people would contest that, but it is definitely a worthy discussion to keep having.
Right. Because that question will bring up inequality among countries. Right. Because they want to find a better place. And why do we have that kind of inequalities among countries? It's a relevant question.
Yeah. Oh, Minjung, you cut out for a little bit.
Sorry.
Is it okay? Yeah. I can hear you now, though. Is it okay if you repeat what you said? Sorry, I couldn't hear you.
No, that's okay. Yeah, I think that question about what is the meaning of the border and why do we have this selective process, that leads us to the issue of global inequality. Ultimately, it's about that. We have this inequalities among countries. Why developing countries are developing countries? Why developing countries do not have what developed countries, right? That's going to bring up a whole lot of issues. Neoliberalism, colonial history, exploitative relationships, military enterprises, all those issues. So I know it's a big question, but it is definitely something that we should ask.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And this brings me to something that you talk about, I think, at the conclusion of your book about multiculturalism fatigue and implication of changing Korean policy. Can you tell us can you tell us more about that, about the impact that it's having on emerging immigrants today?
Right. So what is interesting about Korea's multiculturalism is that Koreans really didn't involve immigrants or migrants into multicultural endeavors. Koreans felt the need to help marriage immigrants. They started multicultural policies, but the immigrants were not invited to the decision-making process. And now, like I said, Korea is a new destination country. So they have newcomers every year, every day, every month, every year. And so as they try to apply multicultural policies, multicultural family policies to these new immigrants that are growing in numbers, they got tired, I guess. So multicultural fatigue, which is a concept that was developed by a Korean scholar, was very fascinating to me because, like I said before, multicultural family policy, it really drew a lot of attention from Koreans. And the Korean government really spent a lot of money and energy. But its result really didn't make that far. There were a lot of good changes. However, I don't think it made that much difference. We are really kind of, we are really on the still on the surface of what multicultural society should look like. But then they started talking about multicultural fatigue. So what I see is that Koreans got really excited about all these immigrants that are coming. In the beginning, they were kind of celebratory mood because they are like, we are so developed now that these immigrants want to come to our country. And then they wanted to help and they made some progress. But after a while, they got tired of it. Okay, what do we have to do more? But even in that position, I don't think they made that much effort to include immigrants into their discussion. There's still divide or separation between the Korean government and immigrant-run organizations. Korean government is still working with Korean-run organizations, but not much with immigrant-run organization. So you have to wonder what kind of multicultural society that they are thinking of, right? Probably they are thinking of being inclusive of immigrants, but still Koreans are the one who calls the shot. Is that a multicultural society? So there are a lot more work to do. We have to admit that Korea has a really, really short history with immigrants. So in a way, we just have to wait and give Korea some time. But on the other hand, it's been almost over 20 years. And we have to think about what kind of changes can we see in the next 20 years. And when we think about that, I don't know how much we can be optimistic. I do want to be optimistic, but I don't know how much I can be. So so that's where, that's how I talked about that. And I was hoping that we could really find ways to move current discourses about immigrants and multicultural families forward. And I guess to answer my own call, I'm working on an edited volume. It's tentatively titled The Redefining Multicultural Families. And I have been working with many young junior scholars in order to expand our discussions on multiculturalism, multicultural families. And first, the thing that I wanted to do was multicultural families should not be just about the families with marriage immigrants. We have to also recognize other forms of immigrant families. So so that's what I'm currently doing. That's what I was thinking of when I was writing that concluding chapter. And I guess I talked a little bit about what I'm doing too.
Yeah. Thank you so much. That sounds like an amazing project. And I was thinking of what does it mean then to have multicultural society, family, when I was reading your book. So I am really looking forward to reading that edited volume. I think that we definitely need to have more conversation about this. And it is very important. And I think you made a very incisive point when you pointed out how the government actually does not have much connection to Filipina-run organizations and how that is just so telling about the type of multicultural society that is actually very exclusive that the South Korean government is creating. So I think that was a really incisive point, and that made me think about how the agency of Filipina immigrant marriage immigrants. And in your introduction, you do talk about social, emotional citizenship. And I was thinking of how in chapter 7, you were talking about the dynamic of sisterly solidarities. So there is group anxiety within, you know, this group of Filipina immigrant, marriage immigrants. But then at the same time, there is a solidarity that is formed. And also, I thought this was really fascinating at an interpersonal level with their in-law families. The performance of heterosexual love, you use scripting theory, allow them to found social citizenship. So I guess shifting the conversation to focus on Filipina marriage immigrants, my question would be, how much agency do you think they have in shaping their own social citizenship, especially because they don't have much of a state connection, it seems? And how important do you think is the connection, various connections that they have to their in-law families, other Filipina organizations and sisters, as well as Korean people that they interact day to day?
Thank you so much for your question. Actually, in one of my articles that I published for this book, talks about my own struggle in discussing agency with marriage immigrants. Oftentimes, people have this binary idea about marriage immigrants, whether they are victims of abusive husbands or matchmaking agents to international marriage, they're not victims, but basically sacrificial lamb for their struggling families in their home, they are seen as opportunists who marry Korean men without necessarily love. They use marriage in order to move to another country, they actually enter the marriage without thinking that they are going to stay in marriage, right? However, of course, these women's real lives, they are more complicated than that. And it was not necessarily, I felt, easy job to convey that. And I guess that was one of the reasons why I wanted to write a book, because you really cannot convey complicated, nuanced relationships that these women have with different people around them. So I really wanted to get a closer look. I wanted to portray their stories closely. And as I do, I wanted to kind of highlight emotional parts in their experiences, because I think there are a lot of connections between their agency and emotional experiences that they have. You see, a lot of people want to highlight agency when people have good lives. However, people still exercise agency when they are having difficulties. Just because they cannot overcome their struggles, that doesn't mean that they didn't have agency. So what does it mean for a person who has agency, who cannot make decisions that they want because the circumstances that they are in did not have that option? I wanted to show their emotional struggles, conflicting feelings that they have. And they all had that kind of complicated relationships with different people. So, so in political science and sociology, people talk about emotions or emotional relationships in public sphere, in social movements, and also their relationship with the state. And I wanted to kind of bring that to interpersonal relationship and how immigrants, marriage immigrants, emotional relationships at the interpersonal level can actually facilitate their relationship with the state. So in the book, each chapter focuses on their relationship with different people. So one chapter focuses on their conjugal relationship. So I talk about different stories, different couples' stories. Some couples, they start with love and their love is a challenge. Some people keep their love because their lives are good. Some people, they lose their love because their lives are so difficult. And I also talk about people who met, not necessarily with deep love, but because there are idea of an ideal family kind of go together, right? Husband wanted to be the provider. The wife wanted to find the provider, and they went well without necessarily deep love. Are we going to say that that is not a good couple? But also I wanted to show how these couples still have, even in their generally good lives, they can have daily struggles for different reasons. In another chapter, I highlighted their relationship with in-laws, not just their husband, but also in-laws. And there I wanted to focus on economic anxiety, right? About how husband's family, they are looking for marriage immigrants because these men could not find their wives. They could not find the wives in Korea because they, in a lot of cases, they live in rural areas or they are from low socioeconomic status. That means a lot of these families have existing economic anxiety before they go into international marriage. And they go into international marriage with all these stereotypes about marriage immigrants, how they are marrying Korean men so that they can help their families back home, how they sometimes want to marry men in order to get into the country. So how are you going to make them stay? You know, all this anxiety that they have can be expressed in not so nice way to wives. But instead of saying that they are abusive, I thought it would be important to show all fuller picture of their experiences. So each chapter kind of looks at these different relationships, including relationships among marriage immigrants and how Filipinas, their relationships have sense of solidarity as well as competition and challenge among themselves. So I hope that when people read the book, they can understand that it is not easy to call somebody's agency by looking at the outcome when they are still living. And it is difficult to say that one could not exercise agency just because they could not make the decision that they wanted. Because a lot of people cannot, but then a lot of people also justify their decisions based on what they have. So I think it's a really complicated issue, but I think it is also important for us that how we understand the agency.
Yeah, definitely. I think that was something that I was thinking about as I was reading your book too, because we often have a very straightforward idea of agency as doing what you want in a way or what you can, but often that is very contextual, as in, you know, it could be the circumstances and it could also be related to power dynamic. There is a social script that you also talk about in your chapter that shapes your desire and then also your agency. And, you know, sometimes they align, sometimes they do not. But then, as you importantly pointed out, even if they do not align, that can also mean agency as well. So how we talk about agency is actually really important. And I think it needs to be more thoughtfully used, which I think you do in your book, which I really loved. So
thank you.
Yeah.
I mean, what is interesting? I mean, for me, an interesting question was not about, I mean, it's not only about ascertaining whether marriage immigrants have agency or exercise agency, but also how a writer can convey their agency, especially those who are in situations where they cannot make decisions for themselves, but they still try to make the best decisions for themselves. So that was something that I had to kind of think about for a long time.
That's such an important question and something that I will probably also struggle with in my dissertation that will come very, very long time afterwards. But I definitely think that as a scholar and as a writer, I think it's just so important to have that ethical question in mind. How do you convey agency for those who are not in the circumstances to be able to exercise it in a traditional way? Thank you for asking that question. And yeah, I have taken a lot of your time. But the New Books Network have the traditional concluding question about your new project, which you already actually talked about in the exciting edited volume that's coming out about the meaning of multiculturalism. But then before we end the show, I still wanted to ask you this final question about, can you tell us more about your new project?
Yeah. So in addition to this new edited volume that is currently titled Redefining Multicultural Families, I'm currently working in my town in San Diego. San Diego is a border city. We are near the U.S.-Mexico border, and our neighboring city is Tijuana. And not many people know about this community, but there is actually a Korean immigrant community in the border region. And they started coming to this region in the early 90s around the time the NAFTA was implemented, and that's North America Free Trade Agreement. And they came with actually Korean multicultural corporations. So originally a lot of Koreans came with their companies, Korean multicultural corporations like Samsung, Hyundai, and of course their subcontractors. But also they stayed, a lot of people stayed. And also they recruited people to the region to work for these companies. They are a rare border commuter who live in the U.S. but work in Tijuana. A lot of U.S.-Mexico border studies, they focus on Mexican or Mexican-American experiences. And usually border commuters, they live in Mexico and they work in the U.S. But these Korean border commuters are the opposite. They are kind of reversed. And they are young community because they started kind of building the community in the mid-1990s. And a lot of them actually went back, but many of them also stayed in the region. So I'm looking at their experiences and what it means to live in the border region, and the border region that straddle two countries that these people are new to, right? A lot of times border residents or border region studies, border studies, I should say, border studies, they talk about people from either country of the border. But these are basically people who are from neither country, and they are trying to learn both countries. So it's an ethnographic study. At the moment, I am interviewing people, but because of my obligations at school, the data collection process, the interview process has been going really slow. But it's been a really exciting project. And I found it fascinating to learn all these different people's path to the area.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that does sound really interesting. And I always knew that San Diego is a really interesting place to be in, precisely as you said, because it's a border town. But I don't think I have read any work that focus on immigrant communities that are from neither countries. And, you know, it just also brings up in my mind all these questions about racialization too, because it's U.S.-Mexico border. So I also really wonder what these immigrants think about their own positionality and their understanding of U.S. versus Mexico, and the fact that they came from, you know, multinational corporations in the South is also very interesting in terms of how they would also situate themselves. Yeah, so it sounds really fascinating. And I know that you're very busy with the schoolwork, but I really look forward to reading it when it comes out.
Yeah. I have one book chapter that just came out. And also, since you are, I mean, I'm usually, when I study immigrant families, I also focus on gender aspect of it. And when I look at these population, it is very, you know, heteronormative families. And it makes me think about how economy, and especially global trades, how they are male-centered. So it's kind of new to me. I have to study, like, you know, economic side of the whole, issue, which is completely new to me. But it has been very, it has been fascinating, to kind of delve into this really new, community, new, population, and also new area of study.
Yeah, I can imagine. And about the gender aspect as well, like, I also think about how, you know, F1 students, they sometimes come in and mostly with male students with their wives, and how wives cannot work at all. And I don't know about the employees, but I imagine it's something very similar. So I think, as you said, looking at the gender dynamic of these very heteronormative families with wives who cannot legally work, but who might work nevertheless, as you actually talk about with the Filipina immigrants as well, marriage immigrants as well, it would be definitely very fascinating.
I actually published the work about the international students' wives long time ago. I can send you the chapter.
I would love that. Because I have really observed how a lot of immigrant, immigrant students, international students, they're mostly males, and they bring their wives over, and they feel very confined about not being able to work. And they also feel pressured in their, like, reproductive labor, in a sense, like domestic labor, and because they are not contributing economically. So I would love to read the work. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. I do want to say that a lot of times it looks like individual decisions, but it has a lot to do with the immigration policy that actually follows that heteronormative model, that you can have one visa holder and the other people should be dependent.
Interesting. This idea of dependency, that's very gendered. But thank you so much, though. Like, I have already taken up too much of your time, but thank you for your all your insights and your amazing book. I enjoyed reading it a lot, and it has been very helpful for developing my own research interest as well. Thank you so much for being in the show today, and I hope that you take care of yourself during the time of COVID.
Thank you. Thank you so much. You too.
Yeah, thank you.